Good evening, everybody. This is Patrick Milliken from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona, as you can see on the sign behind me. Thanks for tuning in to another of our virtual events. We're delighted to have authors Steve Barry and Grant Blackwood with us this evening. They're going to be talking about their new book, The Ninth Man, and gentlemen have kindly signed books for us, and they're on the way to us, or they will be soon, I understand. If you have questions for Steve or Grant, go ahead and put them in the chat field. And I'll also, if you're interested in an autographed copy, we don't have too many left, but I will go ahead and put a link in there should you wish to purchase one. Again, send your questions in. Barbara will bring me on back on screen towards the end of the hour, and I'd be happy to ask any of them. So Barbara, over to you.
Oh, thank you very much, Patrick. What a pleasure it is to see Grant. We haven't seen him for quite a long time, so it's really wonderful to have him back. And Steve Barry as well. And this is the virtual book launch for The Ninth Man that's publishing actually officially tomorrow. Now, I'm going to just address the elephant in the room because it's actually kind of a funny story. If I look stoned, I am. I originally had surgery to repair my arthritic hands scheduled for tomorrow, so we could do the book launch tonight. And my surgeon then called me and said the lure of the 4th of July was such that he was going on vacation tomorrow. And so he was going to do this surgery at 6 o'clock this morning at Mayo. So I have to keep my arm upright above my heart for 2 weeks while it heals. So I can't hide it. So anyway, guys, that's where we are. They didn't believe me when I said I was actually going to do this event tonight at six. But the other part I thought you all like is, you know, there's been a lot of conversation about people doing Zoom events in their pajama pants and whatever it is. I'm actually doing this event in my nightgown. So there we are. Anyway, that's enough about me. I just didn't think that you would want, I didn't want my husband accused of spouse abuse or something while we were doing this. So we're here to talk about The Ninth Man. Now, Steve, this is the 23rd actual book, right? Novel that Steve has done. And I don't remember that you have collaborated in a full-length book with anybody, but I did go and find my copy of Matchup because Steve wrote this absolutely brilliant story with our own Diana Gabaldon for Matchup, which was a book for the Thriller organization. And it was absolutely brilliant. So in order to encourage more sales for it, Steve, remind everybody what it was, because I think it's one of your most imaginative undertakings.
Well, Matchup was a book that an idea I came up with. I was vice president of ITW at the time and head of publications. So I did all the publications, and I had already done Face Off a few years earlier. And that one was dealt with when I took two thriller writers and they faced off against one another with their characters, which was a lot of fun. That book did very well and sold and made a lot of money for ITW. And so we came up with the idea of Matchup, which was boy-girl. And I asked Diana if she would be interested in writing a story with me, and she said she'd love to. So Jamie Frazier and Cotton Malone get together. And it's a very imaginative story. It's a very clever story. It has a very clever ending to it. Diana wrote the first draft because I'm not very good with short stories. And so she wrote the first draft. And amazingly, she wrote it completely from Cotton's point of view. So it was all Cotton. So she basically made my character center stage in her story, which was really lovely of her. I took it and decided it should be a first person. And so we changed it and we went first person present tense and changed it around, and Cotton goes back through the stones, or does he not? It's hard to tell, you know, but it's a really interesting story dealing with a little gap in Outlander history when Jamie is in prison and there's that 18 years when he's away from Claire that there's not a lot written about, so it didn't interfere with her world in any way. And it was a very clever story, and God bless her. It was really nice of her to do it, and nice of her to make her characters, you know, to bring her character to it.
Well, she's a very generous writer, but of course we're all cracked up because Diana's idea for a short story is anybody else's full book. But she did manage to get this one closer to the mark. So Grant, we have known, I knew him principally from the books that he wrote with Clive Cussler. Three, I think, in the Fargo series. Is that right, Grant?
Right, first three, yes.
Yep. And then you've also written in the Clancyverse as well as in your own. Did you write that book with Tom Clancy while he was still alive?
So Dead or Alive was back in 2010, and he was alive. He died in 2013. So that was a collaborative effort. The two I did afterward were after he passed away. So yes.
Right. No, I thought so, but I wasn't sure that you had. So you're one of the people that actually did anybody else write with Tom before you did that first novel?
I think Mark Greaney did as well. Yes.
Yes, you're right. Cause he did spend some actual time with Tom. So anyway, these two authors and their first collaboration, which I believe is an anticipated first of three. Is that right?
That is correct.
Well, so they have had some experience with this. This is not, you know, they're not virgins to the idea of collaboration. And we are in the Magellan Billet universe, right?
Correct.
And Cotton Malone, this is not a Cotton Malone book per se. This is a new guy named Luke Daniels. But Cotton is a mentor to Luke Daniels. And so there are familiar members of the whole Magellan Billet in the book. So. Steve, why don't I, this is your book, not mine, so why don't I sit back and you tell us whatever it is you want to tell us, and I'll interrupt when I feel like it.
Well, I've been wanting to do a series with Luke Daniels for a long time. He was created in the Lincoln Myth, and he's a younger version of Cotton, different than Cotton. He's more impetuous. He gets into trouble. He'll jump in too quickly. Sometimes he doesn't think things through. He's learning. He's learning the intelligence business. And he was fun for that very reason, because I could have him make mistakes. I always thought he could do his own book, could handle his own book, but there's no way in the world I can write two novels in 1 year. There's too much research and there's too much associated with each book, and I just can't. And I wanted to do it. I pitched it to Grand Central, my publisher. They said, yeah, let's do it. So I called Grant and I said, you know, I want to do this, but I need some help. Can you help me out? And he graciously agreed to help me. And I gave him the idea. I had the idea for the first book. I knew what I wanted. It was an idea with the Kennedy assassination that I never could get to work in Cotton's world very well, but it would work just right in Luke's world. We wanted Luke's books to be history with a lot more action adventure. We wanted them to be more Cussler-like in that regard, a lot more action adventure to the story. And that's what Grant does very well. And that's one reason I wanted him on the team, because I knew that's what he was, you know, he was really good at. I'm good with the history. He's good with the action adventure. Together, we should be able to put this together. So he took it and we plotted it out roughly. He took it and wrote a first draft, wrote the whole novel all the way through. And then he gave it to me and I rewrote the novel into a second draft. And why I rewrote it is because I had to put my voice into it, because we're selling this to my fan base. And I had to put Luke into it because I knew Luke better than he did. He's learning Luke, but he didn't know him like I knew him. And we knew that going in. I said, I knew that was going to problem. Just get the first draft. I'll get the second draft. Then we went back and forth and we ended up with a book. And it turned out, I think, really well. It deals with something very fascinating, something real from the Kennedy assassination that I don't think most readers will be familiar with. And it made for a really good thriller.
Yes, it does. I was really fascinated with your theory, which unfortunately, or luckily, if you're watching this, we're not going to discuss and ruin the whole thing. But right. So Grant, what was it like for you to step in? Had you been reading Steve? Was this, or is this just a kind of giant jump for you?
No, I've been reading Steve. I am a few books behind just because I'm older and slower. But yeah, I've been familiar and enjoyed Cotton Malone for many years. So and I knew of Luke Daniels and I knew when he entered the series. And so I had a fair sense of him, but Steve really kind of hammered home. This is who this guy is. And this is the way we want to play him. And it turned out to be a really good time. We enjoyed ourselves.
So which one of you came up with the basic, because there's always an historical basis for your thriller, Steve, which one of you decided on this one?
I did. I had the original idea with the Kennedy assassination and using the theory, which is not mine. It comes from a book that was published in the early 90s called Mortal Error. And I had read Mortal Error and I said, this would be really a great thriller. I just could never figure out how to do it with cotton. But when I thought about Luke, I said, I'd make it work there. And so I gave that to Grant. I said, here's what we want to do. And I gave him a rough outline of how I would have done it if I was writing it. But I said, you're not married to that at all. You go with it. I'm just giving you my take, but you take it and go with it. And then I'll look at all that when I get it and we'll make a decision. I'll make a decision on where we go. It worked out great. He plotted it out. He wrote a rough draft. He got it to me. It took me about 6 weeks and I rewrote it. And then we went back and forth. So we basically put the novel together after he did the first draft in about an 8 week period.
Wow, that's really fast. So yeah. Man, you obviously did a terrific job to make it work so well. Why is it, Steve, that you have said that you couldn't make it work with cotton? What's the obstacle for cotton? It's your time.
For one thing, it's an American-based thriller. So this is the so what of this novel and the ooh factor, as I call it, of this novel is all American-based. And I did 5 American books with cotton, and so I haven't done any since then. He's the international. He's back international. He's going to stay that way. So for me to do another American book, it didn't work right now. And the 5 that I did all dealt with the Constitution and some interesting things from there. I guess I could have probably made it work with the 6th one, but we never went with a 6th American book. So it just didn't work there. Where Luke's books now, this book takes place, half of it in Europe, half of it here. But the actual so what and the ooh of the book is American and has American basis. That's true of this book. The 2nd book in the series will not. The 2nd book will be only totally overseas, totally everything overseas with Luke. The 3rd one probably will come back to America. So I can go back and forth with Luke, where with Cotton, I need to stay overseas because I need to sell these books all over the world. And if you base a book solely in American history, you limit your ability to sell it in markets around the world.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that's true. Although I did think that, I mean, you being a lawyer, I thought that, you know, all the constitutional things in that quintet that you wrote were really fascinating and probably taught many of your readers about things that, you know, they didn't know. But you've always tried to travel, COVID interrupting you, to the destinations that you write about. So Grant, are you going to be able to do some tax deductible travel for these books?
I'm going to try to deduct taxes to Florida, but since we're going to spend part of our time on vacation, I'm going to be careful there. Most of my career, I spent probably too poor to travel and do research. And then I got so busy that I'm too busy to travel. So I'm hoping at some point I'll find some balance and be able to travel and research.
So how do you decide what countries that, did you decide, Grant, which country? Because there are several countries. I mean, this is one of those, you know, sort of chase novels that embraces a lot of travel. Certainly that was always typical of a Kustler, or at least the Kustlers that you were involved in, is that there was movement in different countries. So, you know, were any of those your decisions?
I think they were. I think Belgium was your choice, wasn't it, Grant?
I think it was, yeah. And I think I'd been reading a book about World War I, and I just was fascinated by Belgium and its role, and I started playing with it. I mean, a lot of it is just looking at fascinating locations, and then Steve and I kind of bouncing it around and deciding, yes, this can carry a chunk of the plot, and this is interesting enough. So that's a collaborative part of it too, to see where Luke is going and why.
I think Grant chose all the locations in this book, as I'm pretty sure you did. And I didn't change any of those from the 1st to the 2nd draft. So I think that's right. Those were all yours.
You know, I was really pleased that you visited Luxembourg, because in the years that we had Poison Pen Press before we sold it in 2019, we went to the Frankfurt Book Fair, which was an excellent excuse, you know, to travel around Middle Europe. And Luxembourg, I think, is a really fascinating tiny, is it a principality?
Yes, it is.
Right. And, you know, the city itself is it's a big magnet for corporate headquarters and stuff, isn't it?
And banks, lots of banks.
Right. So a lot of financial stuff, and it has a weird geography. There's lots of hills and canyons and stuff involved. But if you go just a little bit east in, you know, this very small county, you run across the river, the one with all the great grapes.
The Moselle, but that's further.
The Moselle, right. And anyway, we drove along the Moselle, and it turned out to be the most gorgeous country, you know, wooded and beautiful and riverine and all the rest of it. But of course, it's so small, you can drive it in a very short time.
Yeah, it's a very small, tiny little place. And I've always wanted to set a book there, and I was kind of glad Grant did that. In fact, Recently with the book, that next year's book, the Atlas Maneuver that comes out next February, is set in Luxembourg.
Oh, good.
But I had already written that when we were working on this book. So I told Grant when he picked Luxembourg, I said, you don't know this, but I actually set this in a novel. So it worked out very well. And so I got to use it twice. I got double duty out of it.
But didn't the Omega Factor, you're in Ghent, and that is...
We're in Belgium, yeah. Right. Belgium in Omega, Luxembourg in the Atlas Maneuver.
I think this is great because so often, you know, the glamour place like Paris or whatever, you know, cops a lot of the background for thrillers. And I think it's really interesting to be able to go to lesser traveled places like Belgium, for example, and now Luxembourg twice. Yay.
And I try to use these places because I want people, the locales become almost characters in the novel. So I try to keep those unique in each book.
So we have Cherchez la Femme. We have the woman in this book. So Grant, tell us about, is it Gillian or Gillian? Which did you decide it would be?
It is Gillian Stein, yes. You know, Gillian is an interesting character for a lot of reasons, and you've read the book, so you know what I'm talking about. But she's a former Marine, and she broke some glass ceilings in the Marines. She's pretty opinionated, pretty hard driving. She's a good match for Luke. She's been out for a while when they get together and find themselves in this trouble. So she's a bit rusty, but over time she grows back into the Marine she was. And she and Luke become a pretty strong team, I think.
So tell us about Luke, which, you know, we need some background here on Luke because many of your readers may not even remember him at this point.
Well, he was started in the Lincoln myth. He's Danny Daniels, who was my president of the United States, but then his term ran out and he became a senator. Danny's been a central character in the novels for a long time. His nephew is Luke Daniels, who is a former Army Ranger who wants to work in the intelligence business, but he doesn't want his uncle to help him. He wants to get it on his own. He wants to do it on his own. But unbeknownst to him, his uncle does step in and get Stephanie Nail to take a chance on him. And in the Lincoln myth, she takes a chance and hires him. But she makes it very clear if he doesn't cut the mustard, he's gone. He's, you know, she's not going to do a favor for anybody like that. But Luke steps up in Lincoln Myth and he does a good job. And about every other book, he's been interacting with Cotton. He was in The Last Kingdom, which was the book that came out this year, Cotton Malone book. And I knew that we had this book coming this summer. So it was a good lead in for him to get a lead in. And I use him, as I said, off and on within the Cotton books. He's a fun character. He was suggested by my wife, Elizabeth. She said, we need a young, hot guy, which Cotton took great offense to, by the way. Great, great, great offense to. Like, excuse me, I mean, what about me, Cotton said. But she said, no, you know what I mean. So we have I always, when I created him, I thought of Matthew McConaughey. But Matthew McConaughey is probably too old to be Luke. Luke's only in his 30s and he was a little too old to be Luke, but I thought of that attitude and that way of the way he is, that laid backness, but also a caginess that underneath him, that if you, he'll be cool with you. He'll be good with you, but don't cross him too far. You know, he can bite when he needs to. And he's growing. And in this book, he grows. There's a significant growth process for him because he has to deal with some very interesting issues in this book. And he's all alone and he has no help and he's got to figure it out on his own. And to his credit, he does. There's a surprise in the novel. We don't want to talk about it. There's a surprise in the novel that will catch the reader off guard. The reason why it will catch the reader off guard is because we didn't even think of it till we got to that point in the writing. So we never foreshadowed it. We never hinted to it. We never gave you any warning of it. It actually occurred to us at that point, which is towards the end of the book. So it's going to come out of nowhere. And boom, there it is. Now, once it comes, you'll begin to think back on some stuff. But there's a surprise, and Luke has to deal with that. And he deals with that in a very interesting and mature way.
So I should know the answer to this because we talked about The Last Kingdom in February, but maybe it's the drugs that I'm currently on. Was Luke Daniels the guy that was driving the boat?
Yes.
I thank you.
No, he wasn't driving the boat. He was a passenger in the boat.
Okay. But anyway, he was involved in the action. And so, you know, one of the reasons for using him in this trilogy is that are these going to be more, I think you've already said this, but I can't remember if we said it on camera. He's going to be more a thriller, an action-driven thriller.
Action adventure. Yeah, we're going to want more. These books were, the goal is to make them a little more Cussler-like. And that's why I wanted Grant, because he was familiar with that. Grant also wrote for Jim Rollins, so he's familiar with that too.
Right.
So, and Jim likes action adventure as well. So I wanted a little more action adventure. I wanted some history, but I wanted a lot of action adventure. And in with Cotton, there's a mixture, almost 50-50 of those things. But I wanted a little more action adventure with Luke. We get it here. This is a very fast-paced novel. It goes very quickly.
It really does. Which reminds me, Grant, I really miss the dog. I mean, I love the dog that you and Jim have. I've complained to Jim.
You know, Jim did better with Kane than I did. There were times. And I think I told Steve this. There were times I was writing the Tucker Wayne books, and I had an imaginary scene where Tucker Wayne would take the dog to a spa and check him in there and then go do the dangerous things and get the dog back out. And I couldn't write that, but that was my inclination, is to keep the dog out of harm's way, which is kind of not the point. So,
no, not really. Jim will be here on August 14th. This is a big summer of thrillers. Authors who, I mean, Steve, I don't remember that you've ever published. Have you published in June or July?
Before? I have, yes. I did, early on, I did The Third Secret in June. And then I did Omega Factor last year in June. So I've done two June. I've published it every month of the year, I have done that August too. Now I've done every month of the year, every month. Yeah.
Hey, a year-round guy all the way around. Yeah. I tend to think of Steve as a winter author in my mind, you know. I see.
But my main book comes usually in February, yes.
Right. Yeah. And Jim has moved, you know, all over from, he was December for a while, April now, you know.
He's August now, I think.
Yeah, it's an incredibly crowded month, August this year, which is so interesting because normally it's the orphan month.
Yeah, it used to be the dead month, yeah.
You know, that's one of the things that has come out of the pandemic is that schedules have changed because there were necessary delays. It's going to be like that with the writer's strike in terms of, you know, what's going to come out in the video world because projects got delayed and all the rest of it. But it throws me off because, you know, there's a rhythm that you're used to, and then now it's different.
Because usually publishing is closed in August. They basically shut down.
Go to Fire Island. I know. Yeah. Actually, this week, you're at the very end before the 4th of July push. So, you know, it's great that they timed you to do it where people are going to get your book and take it on whatever break there.
Yeah, we hope so. That's what we're hoping for. Yeah. I noticed the bestsellers right now is pretty much dominated by women's fiction. Women's fiction has pretty much got a grip on the top 15 slots on the Times list. So we're hoping maybe we could sneak in there and offer a little testosterone for just a little change.
I just looked at the list, the preview thing in Publishers Weekly, which for those who don't know, it is kind of the trade magazine of the publishing world. And you're right. It's the It's the TikTok Colleen Hoover effect to a great degree. But for a long time, thrillers dominated the bestseller list, and now there's a bit of a switch. But when I say TikTok, it actually TikToks in publishing when stuff comes up and, excuse me, stuff goes down. So we'll see. So Grant, what have you been doing in the interval between last time I talked to you and this book? Because it's been quite a while. Fill us in.
It has. You know, I've been just enjoying Colorado. We moved back here. Nothing to say against Arizona. We just missed the mountains, so we came back here. And you know, when Steve came calling about the collaboration, he generously said that he asked me for help. But really what it was, and I'm afraid to tell him this now because he might ask for it, but I was prepared to pay him money to do it. That's how excited I was. So
really?
You know, and my old standard saying what he asked me, do you want to do this? I gave it all of a half a second of thought. And I said, yes, absolutely, let's do it. And so we're putting book two to bed now, cross fingers. And then we'll turn to book three. And that's kind of where my focus is to put all my effort there.
I think for many authors, writing is like a drug. You know, you just can't give it up. So if you're in withdrawal, it's nice to be able to come back to it and to come back in a place where you're really, you know, well-prepared and comfortable is great.
Well, and Steve and I have very similar thinking about thrillers. And the biggest one, I think Steve would agree, is that for us, it's all about entertainment. I mean, that's why readers pick up thrillers, is to be entertained. And so being on that same page for Steve and I was a big deal.
It is nice. And you know, there's a tremendous amount of push right now for books that are either about politics or they're about cultural issues and so forth. And I think many of us really want, and especially going into summer, I like the idea of a bookcation, you know, where you can really, you know, kind of depart your normal life and enjoy yourself having an adventure, travel, you know, vicariously, whatever it might be. And so, you know, I think this is perfect timing to have some fun like this. So Grant, what was it like to write, you know, a whole first draft? How many mileposts did Steve give you?
You know, it was pretty well mapped out. We knew what we wanted to accomplish and we knew the end goal. The trick really became, and I think Steve has said this, is that the Kennedy assassination, which is central to this book, is a seminal moment in history. And I kind of think of it as it is the greatest unsolved mystery of all time. And so for us, the question became, how do you unravel a mystery that has been buried for 60 years? And what would that look like on the ground? And that kind of became Luke's journey. It starts out in a way that doesn't seem to pertain to anything. And by the end of the book, the reader realizes what an old and mysterious journey they've been on.
Yeah, you guys aren't old enough, but a person my age remembers exactly where she was when the news came out of the assassination. I was actually in a master's class with a law professor at Northwestern University. And when, you know, all of this broke. And then I remember everybody rushed to their TVs, which were, you know, primitive by today's standard, and watched Jack Ruby walk in and, you know, and kill Oswald before. It was just like, you know, it was really weirder than a movie. Mm-hmm. To see that.
I appreciate you saying that I'm very young, but I actually was alive then too.
Okay, but
and I appreciate that though. Good. I was in third grade. I remember it vividly. The nun came in and told the class what had happened.
Yeah,
and I remember, as you just said, watching the television when Ruby shot him,
which was the worst thing that, you know. I mean, that's part of the reason, don't you think, that the conspiracy has arisen, because with Oswald killed, then the real question becomes, What was Ruby doing?
Yeah, and here's what's really fascinating that I doubt most people know. First, one little historical thing. The Kennedy assassination was the very first almost live event television covered as it happened.
Yep.
Today, we're very used to that because we have 24-hour news and they get in there and they go over it ad nauseum over mm-hmm. and over and over. But with the Kennedy assassination, for the very first time, you cut on your television, you sat there in your living room and you were there and you were part of it. And then there you saw it live. Ruby shoot him on live. It was really amazing, an incredible thing, you know, to watch. But the whole event has never really been investigated, to be honest with you. The Warren Commission never really investigated it. They already knew their conclusion and they wrote a report to fit their conclusion.
Yeah.
Yeah, the two congressional investigations were likewise poorly done. There's never been an objective, clear investigation with all of the facts and information sitting in front of you. A lot of the documents are still classified. Trump said he was going to release them and he changed his mind and did not release them. So we don't know what's in those documents. Does it back up the theory from mortal error? Who knows? We don't know the answer to that question. Certainly the withholding of those documents raises some questions. After 60 years, you would think it wouldn't matter anymore. Everyone's dead. Everyone associated with that event is dead. We will never, ever know the truth of what happened on November 22nd, 1963. We'll never know.
No.
But it makes for great thrillers.
Well, no question about that. But, you know, the thing that Ruby compounded the tragedy because he took out, you know, the only person who could actually reveal what was behind it.
And here's something I doubt very many people know. Ruby wanted to talk to the Warren Commission. He wanted to speak to them and they wouldn't talk to him. Ooh. They wouldn't interview him. They wouldn't take a statement from him. They wouldn't do anything from him, which is insane. Why would you not speak to the man? He said, I will talk, but I want to talk to you guys, only to you people. They said, no, we're not doing that. So we never knew what Ruby had to say because he never spoke of the ever publicly of why he did it or what. And he died of cancer a few years later in jail.
You know, last week, Riley Sager, we launched him at the store, and he's based his new book, The Only One Left, on the Lizzie Borden case. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that with modern forensics, we would know whether Lizzie Borden actually, you know, was guilty. So, you know, and it might even still be solvable in some way. I don't have any idea with all the weird stuff they can do now, you know, with DNA and other kinds of evidence. But, you know, there could have been today anyway, a real solution to it. But today, I don't think you could really get to the truth of the Kennedy thing, assuming that Ruby was able to get through the metal detector and actually shoot, you know.
Well, the guy who wrote Mortal Error did a really good job, because the theory that's in that book is a very plausible theory that makes a lot of sense. And he did a lot of good work on it. And a lot of the stuff in that book is hard to refute. And there's a lot of things that happen afterwards that give credence to what was written in Mortal Error. For example, the Secret Service removed Kennedy's body and took it back to Washington over the objections of the Texas authorities. They would not allow the Texas Medical Examiner to examine the body. That body was never looked at by the Texas authorities. And at that time, killing a president was not a federal crime. That was a Texas murder. And that body should have stayed in Texas and should have been autopsied so that they could put together the evidence they needed for a trial. But the Secret Service at gunpoint removed the body and took it back to Washington. The subsequent autopsy in Washington was poorly done. Very little was gleaned from it at all. And most of the records and photographs from that autopsy no longer exist, which is very interesting, all very interesting.
It is very interesting. But, you know, you just said something that really surprised me. I had no idea that killing a prisoner was not a federal crime. Did it become one as a
crime? Yes, after 1963. But in 1963, that was not a federal crime. That was a state murder, a Texas murder. And that body should have been examined by the Texas medical authorities, autopsied, and then released. Secret Service would have none of that. They took him right from the operating room, right to the plane. Put him on the plane, took him home.
You know, a staple of thrillers and many other forms of crime fiction is conflict and territoriality between investigative bodies. I mean, you know, many thrillers have big sections where, you know, it's like the FBI facing off against the local police or the CIA or whatever it is. And I didn't realize that had actually happened.
No, it was very, it was a very confrontational situation. The medical examiner confronted the Secret Service, insisted that the body stay. And as I said, at gunpoint, they basically took the body and left, which was against the law. They actually broke the law to do all that. If Oswald had have lived and we would have had to try him, there would have been a serious problem with some of the evidence there and the chain of custody of that evidence, because no one had control of that body. It was being moved all over everywhere. So Oswald, if Oswald had had a subsequent trial, they could have had some serious evidentiary problems.
Wow. So every thriller needs a great villain, right? And so we have not talked about Thomas Rowland. So Grant, was Thomas Rowland your creation?
No, that was a joint creation. We wanted a guy, you know, I think of Thomas Rowland as the kind of behind the scenes puppet master that you never hear his name, but he has just amazing influence. And if you do hear his name, it's probably the last name you hear, because he's gotten interested in you and things are going to go bad for you. But he's a longtime CIA guy who lives in a very dark world, does dark things, and he is hugely influential. But he's one of those ones you don't hear anything about, because that's the way he wants it.
Thomas Henry Rowland, yeah, he's an amoral sociopath.
Yes.
And
that sums it up. Wow. You're not missing any words there.
He's named after a friend of mine here in the neighborhood. He's one of the neighbors.
Another amoral sociopath?
No, he's not. I tell people all the time, when I use your character, your name for a character, the character is not you. Doesn't look like you, talk like you, act like you. It's just your name. And you're not the only one in the world with that name. So, but Tom wanted to be a character in the book. And I said, well, you want to be a bad guy? He said, yeah, I love to be a bad guy. So I play golf with Tom all the time. And he's the amoral sociopath. A lot of the characters in the book are neighbors here in the where I live. There's a lot of neighbors in there.
So that brings up a question that often comes up in these conversations where people ask authors about naming. You know, how do you come up with the names for your characters? So Grant, when you were writing with Clive, the Fargo series, did Clive come up with all those names? You know, or was that a collaborative thing?
It was a collaborative thing. There, you know, Sam and Remy were Clive, of course. But I think most of the character names I came up with, if he didn't like it, he would, of course, tell me. There were a couple times we had a laugh, because Clive was known for his outrageous names in the Dirk Pitt books. And he'd come back to me a couple times and says, you know, this name is kind of ridiculous. And I'd have to point out, you know, Clive, you had some pretty ridiculous names, didn't you? But it was mainly me. And if Clive didn't like it, he'd let me know.
Well, he would. That's very true. So where did you go for names? I mean, how do you decide what to call a character? And is that influenced in any degree by characteristics? That's a terrible phrase. Characteristics of the character. But names have freight, don't they? Names have emotional freight.
Oh, yeah. You've got to be careful how you name the characters. And I tell people all the time, the name has to fit. And Thomas Henry Rowland was perfect for this guy.
Yeah, it's a
perfect name for this guy. And I have to say, I'm probably at fault in here more than Grant is, because I changed all the names in the book. And I had not explained to Grant beforehand how I like to name things after people. He understands now, and so he understands how we do it now. But I knew I wanted to use a lot of the neighbors here for the book.
And
why? Well, it's just fun. I mean, they get a big fun out of it. They enjoy it. And I used a lot of the people. We built a house here. And in The Last Kingdom, most of the characters are the people who worked on this house. They were the craftsmen who worked on this house were there. And Derek Coker, who's big in the novels in The Last Kingdom and in coming up next year as well, is the builder who built this house. So I like to do that, but it's got to fit. And I have to be careful, though, because you don't want the names to all start with the same letter.
Right.
And you don't want them to sound the same. So I got to be careful about that. And but I'm probably at fault. I like to name it. It's fun. I mean, the people enjoy it and they get a big kick out. I only do it with people I know and people who are good sports about it.
I don't think at fault comes into it at all. But, you know, I think all of us have emotional weight that we put on names, probably based on people we knew or, you know, life experiences. I mean, I shouldn't say one, but there's one male name that just never works for me. And when, even when I'm reading a book and it comes up, you know, it kind of puts me off. So
tell us what that is.
No, I'm not going to tell you. It's not Steve Grant. It's not Steve Grant. You know, if you're using real people's names, then I can see that. But I was really sort of thinking about, we've had people talk to us about somebody went back and looked at the old plague rolls, for example, and might have even been you in the Last Kingdom. I can't remember. But, you know, looked for interesting names that had appeared in, death rolls, or, you know, looked in old phone books, or.
I used to do that. I used to use old phone books and all. And I tend to use now people I know. It's fun and I enjoy it. I would never do it to a stranger. And I don't do auctions anymore. Where
I was going to ask you, because for a long time, people would pay for a naming.
I don't do that anymore because I don't know you and I don't know how you are. And I know of a writer who got sued for that.
Really?
Yeah, because he used a name and the guy said, well, you made me look bad. And guy said, it's not you. It's not you. It's just your name. It's not you. But yeah, they had problems. But I don't do that. I do it with people I know and people who are good sports about it and who want to be in there, who would say, yeah, I love it. I want to do it. Now, I never use a real person's name if a character is like if it was to be a pedophile or something. I would never use a real name there or something like that. I had a character once who was a very cruel, mean, vicious kind of guy who really hurt people. And I used a fictitious name there. I don't do it there at all. But Thomas Henry Rowland was fun. He's just an amoral sociopath who does crazy crap. And Tom loved it. He enjoyed it. He's embraced the character. We're doing an event here in Orlando on Wednesday night, and he will be there. So
you can make him a star. So what about Jillian Stein, Grant?
Was she there? Will be there too.
Oh yeah?
She's a real person too.
Right. Well, you've come up with some interesting names in the Cotton Malone series, Cotton Malone being one, for sure. Anyway, moving on. Grant, what was your original contribution to this book? Is there one you can name?
My original contribution?
Yeah, not from Steve, something that was Grant.
You know, I think mainly it was just the way it played out. I mean, Steve and I kind of knew what needed to happen throughout the book, but I think one of the things I love doing is how they get from point A to point B, what happens in Luxembourg and where they do it. So that was all pretty original. Steve and I would bounce things back and forth to make sure they were working right and we were heading the right direction. But I love that part, kind of going from scratch and getting Luke in trouble and figuring out where that's going to happen, what it's going to look like.
That was all you, because you did that all in the first draft. So all that. All that progression was yours. I made some changes to it, but it's pretty much stuck to the format that you had.
And I think the beautiful thing about that is that, I mean, when I'm doing that, I'm really close to the forest. So it's hard to see the trees. And when Steve gets it, he's able to look at it kind of at a God's eye view and see if it fits our whole model. So it worked really well that way.
So when you came back to the U.S., you picked a couple of locations. Which ones are those?
He picked them all, so they're all yours, man.
The bayou. We went deep in the bayou to find somebody that Luke needs to find. And, of course, we end up where it all happened 60 years ago, Dallas Dealey Plaza. And then it ends up in the middle of nowhere. Up in Montana, or excuse me,
Wyoming.
Yeah, Wyoming, near Yellowstone, not far from Yellowstone.
So it really is a tour. And I think that, you know, it's almost impossible to write a thriller that just takes place in a static location, isn't it? Doesn't there need to be?
By definition, you can't. It's got to be big. It's got to be, you know, big. And I like different places. And I told Grant that. I said, don't get locked into one place now. Move around. And he did. He moved around. He went from Belgium to Luxembourg to Louisiana to Texas to Wyoming. So we got a good run around the world here.
Right. Sometimes it's fun. You know, when I'm getting ready to write up a book for readers, I usually try to include the arc of, you know, the travel arc, because I think that can attract people. You know, they want to read something about, you know, like Luxembourg, for example, which is great. I think maybe if we talk anymore, we're going to get into trouble by revealing too much of the book. So why don't we call Patrick up and see if there are questions from the audience?
All right.
All right, let's see here. Can we still order this book? Yes, you can. I just put in a link for signed copies. You can get them here. Let's see. Yeah, and a number of people were surprised, Barbara, that shooting a president wasn't a federal crime at that time. That's really interesting.
Because there have been presidents that were shot, like McKinley, for example, was
right.
That was not that was a local murder.
Right. And where was he? Was he in New York?
New York.
Yeah. So yeah. New York actually had jurisdiction and
they tried him. They tried the assassin, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He was pretty much insane, as a
right. No, I remember. I mean, there wasn't really any question about, is everybody satisfied, for example, that John Wilkes Booth is the guy that really shot Lincoln?
Pretty much, I think so, yeah.
But hasn't there been just a little bit of...
Little bit, but I mean, he jumps down from the balcony onto the stage and breaks his leg. Everybody sees him. I think the circumstantial evidence is pretty strong.
And there was a conspiracy circle around him, or
there was no question there was a conspiracy there, because they went to kill the Secretary of State, the Vice President, all of them. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. But with Kennedy, we don't know.
We don't know.
It was a lone actor, or whether, you know, there are various theories that have been advanced about whether it was an international group, whether it was local people, you know, whether
we have no idea, nor will we ever know.
Right, tragically.
Steve, do you have the numerous main theories about that? Do you have a favorite? Do you have one that you
like the one we're used in this book. I'll be honest with you. It makes perfect sense. The evidence that the writer accumulated from his test firings and other things makes perfect sense. And I like the theory from Mortal Error. It explains an awful lot.
Mm-hmm. Right. I meant to point out, too, it's really hard to, if I hold it up really closely, I must admit, when I got the book, I couldn't figure out who the blurry figure, I can't use that hand.
I can see him, yeah.
Yeah, the blurry figure there.
We wanted him there, but not there.
Yeah, it's an interesting cover. How much participation did you two have in the cover design?
Well, I had originally designed another cover, and we had a different cover, and we were all good with it. And then one day, they called me up from Grand Central and said, we came up with a new idea, and they sent me that. I had called it the ninth man with the word ninth, because, you know, the old rule is you don't use a number in a title. But I don't know if that applies much anymore in the electronic age. You probably, you know, as the old days, it was the way the books were indexed and the way they were alphabetized. The number messed everything up. Today, I don't think it matters. So they came back and said, let's change it to the ninth with the letter nine and put Kennedy in the middle. And I said, that's a beautiful cover. Mm-hmm. And so really that was really Grand Central's creation.
Wow, points to them, because I think it's very effective.
It's very well done. It is.
Back to you, Patrick. Sorry.
I was going to say there are lots of controversies or conspiracies around the whole Zapruder film footage too, you know, how that's been doctored with, and are very interesting.
We touch on that a little bit in the book, and we touch on something else relative to that too.
Cool.
Can't tell you, but we'll give away, but we do.
Right. And other people are just weighing in, you know, about where they were when they heard the news. I mean, yeah. This dates me. I just remember when John Lennon was shot. That was the big thing when I was a kid.
And then 9/11. Most people
can't
remember exactly where they were. I mean, there are, you know, collective experiences that revolve around a tragedy with that kind of highlighting. But Steve makes such a good point. And you know, Steve, I was thinking it wasn't just the Jack Ruby shooting on television, but the you know, the whole funeral thing.
Funeral
went on, and it was so heavily run and documented. You know, the little boy, you know,
it was only three stations in those days. All three ran that entire story 24 hours a day for over a week.
And people were riveted to it. I mean, it was like, you know, it really was a collective viewing and, you know, going through. I mean, we all felt like we were part of the funeral and embraced the train, you know. I mean, it wasn't just the funeral itself, but
it was the very first time that ever happened with television. We take for granted that today, but that was the first time it was ever done.
It was on television, but if you've been to Vienna, there was actually a whole movie of Franz Joseph's funeral that you can still watch. And I do think that a lot of people, but they weren't watching it in real time.
No.
Which makes a big difference. But, you know, it was a very long documentary. I remember looking at it in whatever museum in Vienna they happened to be running it.
I can remember vividly Ruby shooting Oswald.
Yeah, me too. The visceral impact of it. It's one of those images that it was so fast, but yet I think it just sears right into people's brains.
Yep.
And he was such a kind of nondescript guy, you know. I mean, it wasn't like he came in like Arnold Schwarzenegger or anything, you know. He was not an impressive.
He was known to the local police, so that's why he could go down there. They knew him.
Yeah.
And he worked his way in. Now, why did he kill Oswald? We have no clue.
And we
never he never said a word. He never said why. Never. He wanted to tell the Warren Commission, but they wouldn't talk to him.
So you have to wonder, was it, you know, a personal vigilante thing, or was he an agent of somebody else? Those are the only really two possible explanations.
So. I never know.
No. Anyway,
Patrick, exactly. Let's see. Renee would like to know if either of you is going to be doing a physical in-person event in southeastern Florida by any chance.
Well, not southeastern Florida, but we will be, well, kind of. We'll be in Vero Beach Thursday night at 6:00. I believe it starts at 6:00 in Vero Beach. It's called the Vero Beach Book Center. So it's on the It is on the southeast coast of Florida, about 2 hours from Orlando. We will be there. We'll be here in Orlando on Wednesday night in Winter Garden. Both of those events are on my website, steveberry.org.
There you go, Renee. Start driving. Start driving now. Kelsey would like to know, did you talk with Robert Kennedy, the Democrat running for president, in the process of researching this?
No, we didn't. We did not. No.
No, I wouldn't think so. Let's see here.
There is, by the way, a book that has just come out, the title of which is temporarily escaping me, which is a whole book about the Kennedy clan in Hyannisport. It's called The Summer. I can't use my phone because I can't do that to look it up, but there was a piece, I think, in the New York Times book review about it, Summer and Something, I think is the title, but it embraces the whole Kennedy family history is really, it's like a Greek tragedy, you know, it really is. It's actually, Joe Kennedy was, and you know, the elder daughter who, that was another, you know, they were a family, really hubris would be a, you know, the connotations of the word hubris could really apply to the Kennedys, but it was almost like they were both blessed and cursed.
Yeah, there was a lot of triumph and tragedy there.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ted, his whole drama. And of course, Bobby, you know, just a few years after Jack. It must have seemed very just apocalyptic at that time with, you know, all these people getting assassinated, one right after the other, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X.
Yeah, but the 60s were an apocalyptic time, Patrick.
Yeah.
Because, you know, after the war, everybody was kind of fused together. So I'm a child of the 1950s, as you know. And, you know, there was a much greater sense of kind of common unity. And then the Vietnam and it all split, everything splintered, and lots of lots of things happened. 1969 in Chicago, or 68, I think it was 68, now that I think about it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was a whole bunch of things that were very unsettling.
Watergate came along and changed everything because we learned to distrust government.
Right.
We became very distrustful and everything altered after that.
Yep. Yep.
Well, it's interesting looking at the crime, you know, because I do a discussion group here and we talk about, you know, the crime novel and how it evolves over time, you know, and in the late 60s, you see the trend where the bad guys are no longer the bad guys. The bad guys are the police, you know, and the bad guys, you know, very interesting.
Right. And, you know, we're in the middle of a whole thing about fake news and so forth. And Matthew Porco was at the store last week. He's the author of The Night Agent, just reading a wonderful piece on Netflix. We're, you know, I was remembering, we used to all sit down. I mean, people all sat down and watch Walter Cronkite every night and believed everything he said. You know, there wasn't any discussion about fake news or whatever, you know. He had an ability to, you know, state the moment, bring everybody into the moment that is impossible to achieve today.
No, because we don't do news in 30 minutes anymore. We do news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So you have to fill it up. And it's not about news anymore. It's about ratings, it's about entertainment.
Absolutely.
Just entertainment, and that's all it is. It's not really news anymore.
No, and filled with unreliable narrators.
Yeah, because it's designed to entertain you, not inform you.
Yeah.
Where Cronkite was trying to inform you.
He really was. Absolutely true.
You get Fox and MSNBC essentially the exact same. You know, they're selling their own little narrative.
Sure. It's entertainment. It's all it is.
Yeah.
I'm going to be launching Jake Tapper in a couple of weeks. And when I talk to Jake, I never actually bring up any of this. You know, I think that his CNN career should be an entirely different thing than his authorial career when we're talking. Mm-hmm.
At least when we go live. When we don't have him live, we can chat with him a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. We digress. Maybe we should
always do. Anything else?
Another question?
Let's see. Well, you've already kind of gone over some of these things. When is book two going to come out? Is it going to be a year?
Well, yeah. Well, what will happen is book two will be next summer and book three will be the summer after that. We're finishing up book two right now. It's going to deal with Russia and something very interesting that I've been wanting to do for a long time with a Cotton Malone book is the Lost Library of Ivan the Terrible, which was a real library that disappeared in the 15th century. And I've been wanting to use it in a thriller and I couldn't figure it out. And Grant figured out a way to make it work.
Wonderful.
And so I kept asking, I said, I sure want to do this, And finally he said one day, you know, I think I figured out a way, and he did. So it's going to be, it's an interesting novel that Luke gets caught up. A lot of action adventure in this one, a lot. But dealing with something very interesting. And in the third book, I have the idea. I'm going to talk to Grant about it when he comes to visit. He's coming to see me in a couple of days. So I'm going to talk to him about it then.
Sounds good. That's about it for the questions.
Wonderful. Is there anything you guys would like to say that we haven't covered?
No, that's the book's going to be out, you know, starting at 12 o'clock tonight. And it will be out in stores everywhere. So everybody, please check it out. Give it a chance. Take a look at it. You can find out more about that books and all of my books at steveberry.org. And Grant, give them your website.
GrantBlackwood.com.
Yay. And let me say that our copies are in Florida waiting for Grant, so that our autographed copies will be autographed by Steve and by Grant. And so that's really wonderful for those of you who can't attend the live events in Florida. So please feel free to order them. And Patrick put the link into the comments field. And you can also just call the store, 888-560-9919.
And one thing I'll say, Barbara, is if they want to order the book and have it personalized, I have a list of all the ones that you have so far. But if Patrick will just send me an updated list, we'll personalize some more. Somebody wants to order them now and have them personalized.
Okay, what day are you signing them?
I'm going to sign those Thursday morning.
Okay, So if you want a personalized copy from that we can provide for you, you're going to need to tell us by Wednesday evening so that we can send the updated Excel list to Steve on Thursday morning.
That'd be fine, because we're going to sign all those Thursday morning, so they'd be picked up after lunch.
That'll be wonderful.
There's and one then more question that's coming in here.
What?
It's just, will either of you be at the VoucherCon in San Diego this year?
I will not.
No?
I have no plans. I mean, I don't plan more than a day or two ahead of time anyway, so we'll see what happens.
San Diego has its charms.
I'm really looking forward to it. I've been frustrated, but I didn't get to Thrillerfest this year. This appears to be my family year for having surgery. My husband had cervical spine surgery 4 days before Thrillerfest, and that meant that he couldn't drive or pick up anything and whatever, so I had to cancel. I donated my membership to Thrillerfest so that somebody maybe who couldn't afford it could go.
Right.
I was very disappointed to miss it, so I'm very much looking forward to VoucherCon. For those of you who don't know what it is, it's a mystery conference, international in scope, lots of interesting authors, several days of programming, and it moves. So it's in San Diego this August. It'll be in Nashville end of August next year. So it's an opportunity to visit different cities and meet different groups of writers. Anyway, thank you all very much for joining us tonight. It's really a pleasure. Grant and Steve, thank you for letting us do the virtual launch for your book.
Thank you.
Delighted to have been able to do. And when we have information about Atlas, remind me the title, what's it called?
The Atlas Maneuver.
Right. Yeah. We can't put it up on our website for you to order yet because we actually need a little more information from the publisher. But Steve will be able, I hope, anyway, he's going to come and join us in February.
I'll be touring for that book. Yeah, I'll be back on the road.
Great. And so you'll be able to meet him then and, you know, order a copy in advance. So good night, everybody. Thank you.
Good night.
Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.